Have diet scientists been feeding us junk food when it comes to advice on why we get fat?
By the 1980s, they had launched this huge public health armada aimed at getting the entire nation to eat low-fat diets and getting us to avoid saturated fat and to eat lean meats, and all the discussion was about fat when it used to be about sugar.
That's Gary Taubes. We spend the hour with him talking about his latest book, The Case Against Sugar. It follows on the heels of his previous books, Why We Get Fat and Good Calories, Bad Calories. That's what's on the menu today on Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Obesity and diabetes are at an all-time high, not just in the U.S., but worldwide. In the U.S., more than two-thirds of adults are obese or overweight, and some 10% have type 2 diabetes. Once, it was an exceedingly rare disease. Why is this happening? We've long been told that the problem is our sedentary lifestyle and eating too much fat. But Americans have actually been exercising more and eating more low-fat foods while the obesity and diabetes epidemics have continued to rise. My guest Gary Taubes says the problem isn't fat or even lack of exercise. It's sugar. And not just sugar, but also processed grains like white flour, which turn quickly into sugar in the body. In the process, it's not only causing us to get fat, but also greatly upping our risk for diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and Alzheimer's. And while sugar is bad for everyone, it's even worse for kids. In a recent article in The Guardian, Gary Taubes says, for children's health, the government should treat sugar like cigarettes. Taubes has been arguing the issues for more than a decade, ever since the publication of his 2002 New York Times Magazine piece, What If It's All Been a Big Fat Lie? He went on to write two books about the issue, Why We Get Fat and Good Calories, Bad Calories. Now he's come out with a third, The Case Against Sugar, in which he details how dietary science got the cause of obesity so terribly wrong, and his theory about why sugar is the real culprit. Gary Taubes, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, you've written this book, The Case Against Sugar. You've also written about the same issue in general before, Why We Get Fat and Good Calories, Bad Calories. Some of what you wrote in those books appears in this one. What got you on the trail of this topic about sugar?
Well, it's a long story that I'll try to make short. Since the mid-80s, I've specialized in investigative science journalism and focusing on controversies. And in scientific controversies, usually there's a right side and a wrong side, and the right side is doing good science and the wrong side is doing bad science. And the joy from a journalistic perspective is trying to figure out who's right. As I was doing this, some of my friends in the physics community who appreciated my efforts suggested I look into public health because they said the science there was terrible. And I went and moved into public health research in the early 90s, and they were right. The science was pretty bad, and it was a fruitful area for an investigative reporter. And by the late 90s, I had stumbled into this nutrition field almost serendipitously. And turned out some of our core beliefs about what constitutes a healthy diet were just based on completely uncompelling evidence. Sort of people get ideas, they get hypotheses, they believe the hypotheses have to be true, and then they go out and test them. And when the hypotheses fail the test, they decide they did the test wrong because they've already decided that the hypothesis has to be true. So the idea that, you know, salt causes high blood pressure was the first one of these. I did a long investigation for the journal Science, and then that got me into this question of, is a low-fat diet de facto a healthy diet? And I wrote my first two books about this world, and there was always a sort of alternative hypothesis, which is the cause of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and all these diseases that associate with them, are the carbohydrates we eat, not the fats in our diet. So this last book was focusing on the role of sugar as the sort of prime suspect for what really triggers all these diseases.
Yeah, and it's really a fascinating look into the kind of history of science of it, and we'll go into that more deeply. But, you know, when I grew up in the 1960s and 70s, my mother always told me that sugar was poison. And I never thought that that was a particularly unusual point of view. Maybe it was just that she brainwashed me. And it seems to me that in your book, I mean, there were people who understood that at one time, and then that idea went away. Talk about, first of all, why were some of the original ideas about sugar correct, and what were they? And then why did that idea go away?
Well, and that's what's so fascinating in the story, and also one of the reasons why I invariably take a historical perspective in these books, because it seems strange in 2017 to be even making the argument, in effect, that sugar is poison, to use your mother's terminology. And in order to do it, you have to explain why we didn't think this way, and then, as you pointed out, we clearly did at one point, so what happened? And it's interesting. My mother was, she went to said it was poison, but clearly sugar was always something that you had to ration if you were a parent. So you knew your kids would eat it to excess, whatever that means, and you had to control them. And yet somewhere along the line in the 1970s, 1980s, this control slipped away, which is fascinating. And one of the reasons it did is because we became obsessed with this idea that dietary fat is the primary evil in modern diets. So, again, this gets back to my earlier books and my second investigation for the journal Science. First, you know, a handful of researchers decided that heart disease was caused by dietary fat and then saturated fat, and it was working to raise cholesterol, and the idea is this sort of clogged your arteries, which is a simplistic way to think of a very complex disorder. That, you know, it became a viable hypothesis. People started spending money to test it. The media got involved in writing about it. And everybody kind of wrote about it like, surely it's true. We just have to get the evidence to find out. And then Congress got involved. And then the U.S. Department of Agriculture got involved. And then the National Institutes of Health got involved. And they all had the same attitude. Surely it's true. We just have to generate the evidence to prove it's true. And by the 1980s, they had launched this huge public health armada aimed at getting the entire nation to eat low-fat diets and getting us to avoid saturated fat and to eat lean meats, and all the discussion was about fat when it used to be about sugar and other, you know, there was this sort of conventional thinking up until the 1960s that carbohydrates, grains, potatoes, and sweets and beer were uniquely fattening. And then with this focus on dietary fat causing heart disease, you're supposed to eat a low-fat diet, replace the fat with carbohydrates. And by the 1980s, not only had we turned the carbohydrate into kind of a heart-healthy diet food, you probably remember the era when suddenly we were all eating baked potatoes every night, just not eating the butter and the sour cream.
Yeah.
You know, our mothers would have thought baked potatoes were fattening. By the 1980s, they became diet foods. And again, in the process, the unintended consequence of this was that suddenly sugar was kind of perceived as benign. And the other thing that happened in this year is we introduced a new kind of sugar into the food system, which was high fructose corn syrup. So that initially came into the food system in 1977 to replace the sugars. It was designed to replace the cane and beet sugar used to sweeten Coca-Cola and Pepsi. And by 1984, it had pretty much replaced all the sugar in sugary beverages. And we didn't actually know that this was just another form of sugar. It's the same chemical constituents in a slightly different proportion. So it's effectively sugar. Our body treats it as sugar, but we didn't know it was sugar. So all these foods, the iconic example is yogurt. You know, you take full-fat yogurt, and it's suddenly by the 1980s were convinced that that's going to give you heart disease, so you remove a little of the fat, or all of the fat. Now you have this insipid, watery, tasteless substance that nobody's going to eat, so how do you make it? To eat it, you add high fructose corn syrup, sugar, and maybe some fruit, and then you call it a heart-healthy diet food. So, you know, it's in the process sugar got this free pass. And then there was this other belief system that I discuss in the book as the gift that keeps on giving, which is this idea that obesity is just caused by taking in more energy than we expend. Sort of like saying people get rich because they make more money than they spend. You know, it describes what happens when somebody gets rich, just like this other idea describes what happens when somebody gets fat, but it doesn't tell you anything about how that happens or why. So anyway, we had this belief system, and in this belief system, the worst you could say about sugar is that it's empty calories. It's, you know, it's not about the physiological effect or that this food could be some kind of poison that works to literally to increase fat accumulation in the human body or literally to cause a diabetic state. The worst you could say is that it's just too many calories. And so that, too, you know, by the 1960s, 1970s was used by the sugar industry and the researchers to say that there's, you know, there's nothing really wrong with consuming sugar other than you don't want to overconsume calories.
So explain this notion, the hypothesis that you use, and you do say it's a hypothesis because it hasn't been proved, although there's a lot of indication of why sugar operates differently, or particularly the way we eat sugar, or the kinds of sugars that we eat. Maybe you can clarify that too. Why it operates differently than other calories?
Well, I see all my books as being about sort of good science and bad science and the sociology of science and how scientists think and why they think what they think. And I'm almost embarrassed that I didn't really realize this in my two earlier nutrition books. Scientific advances are basically defined, and scientific thinking is defined by the technologies that scientists have available to study problems. So, you know, if all you've got are telescopes that work in the visual spectrum, all you could learn about the universe is what you could see, you know, with your eyes once you develop radio telescopes and infrared telescopes. And, you know, you can start learning entirely new things about the universe and asking different questions and getting different answers. In nutrition, for the first the history of modern nutrition begins in the 1860s with the invention of technologies that allowed researchers to measure how much energy humans or dog subjects expend in day-to-day life. These are room-sized devices called calorimeters. And calorimeters measure the calories expended by people. And so from the 1860s to the 1920s, all of nutrition science was basically measuring the calories in food and the calories expended by food, by humans and other animals. And you can measure the vitamin and mineral content in the foods, and you could see what happens when animals or humans have to eat diets that are devoid of certain vitamins and minerals. So that was all of nutrition science. And by the 1920s, we had this theory that obesity was caused by caloric excess, because that's all you could measure were calories. And that theory, for reasons, despite having written about and studied it, it just got locked into how we think about obesity, this idea that somehow this is a law of nature, that, you know, fundamental, people get fat because they overconsume calories. And so the only way foods affect our health, at least our weight, our body fat, is through their caloric content. And the fact is, foods do a lot of things to our different bodies, and different foods do different things. And you can think of it the way we think of medications. For instance, you know, Zoloft is an antidepressant, and Lipitor is a cholesterol-lowering drug, and we assume that the dose of the drug has some effect on what they do, right? Because the bigger the dose, the more we think they'll do it. But we don't say these drugs do the exact same things because we're giving the exact same dose, because we know the drugs are metabolized in different organs by different cells. They have different effects, they're metabolized at different speeds, and we care about how fast the drugs make it into the system, and we think about, you know, should we, how to time the delivery of the drug to have a maximum or a beneficial effect, and whether we'll get a negative effect if it's delivered too quickly. All these things come into account. In nutrition, all we cared about was the dose, which is calories. And we said the only thing that matters is the dose, when we knew that every macronutrient is metabolized by the body differently. It's put in different organs. It metabolized in different organs. It stimulates different hormonal responses, just like different drugs do. So when we're talking about sugar compared to other carbohydrates, so most carbohydrates, grains, starches, break down into primarily glucose upon digestion, and then the glucose is absorbed into the bloodstream, and blood sugar goes up. Blood sugar is technically blood glucose. So your blood sugar levels rise. You secrete insulin in response to basically tell yourselves to take up that blood glucose and use it for fuel. The sugar is, the reason sugar is sweet is half of the sugar molecule is a molecule of fructose. And fructose is the sweetest of the carbohydrates. So cane and beet sugar are a molecule of glucose bonded to a molecule of fructose. High fructose corn syrup is 45% glucose and 55% fructose. And that fructose happens to be metabolized in the liver. So the glucose gets into the bloodstream, stimulates insulin secretion, your blood sugar goes up, insulin levels go up. The fructose is metabolized in the liver. So an entirely different organ than any other nutrient. And the idea is that while we see, you know, evolutionarily there was always fructose and sugar in our diet because fructose is what makes fruit sweet. So a medium-sized apple has about the same amount of sucrose and fructose that about 3 ounces of apple juice does. But you might eat that apple. Well, that apple's only going to be in season a couple months a year, throughout until, you know, the last 50 years when we can transport them up from, you know, Argentina during the winter. So you're only going to eat those apples a few months a year, and it's going to take you a while to consume it. And that's going to slow down the digestion, and the sugars are bound up with fiber in the apple, which is going to further slow down the digestion. Instead, what we have is a situation where, so the fructose from that apple is going to slowly dribble down on the liver, and the liver evolved to deal with that. What it didn't evolve to deal with is having fructose dumped on it, you know, in pretty high doses, pretty quickly from fruit juices or sugary beverages or candy bars, whatever it is, and then having it dumped on repeatedly every, say, 2 or 3 hours of the day. So that's the argument here, that when you do that to the liver with this sort of repeated high doses of fructose, kind of hammering it every few hours of the day, as opposed to, and day-long and month-long and year-long, as opposed to sort of seasonally with a slow dribble, you end up with entirely different effects, and the effects happen over the, you know, period of years to decades to be, you know, toxic, chronic.
So you talk about in this book, Gary Taubes, in The Case Against Sugar, you show the incredible increase over, I guess, the last maybe 150 years of our consumption of sugar. Give us a brief sense of how, you know, kind of what was the baseline for, you know, we don't even have to go that far back. Let's say before the Industrial Revolution and today.
Well, so if we go back to the, let's say 200 years ago, early 19th century, per capita sugar availability in this country, we don't actually know how much of this was consumed, but on average, people were getting about the amount of sugar in a 12-ounce can of Coca-Cola every 6 to 7 days. Okay, so that's about 5 to 10 pounds of sugar per capita per year, and most of this would have been wealthier people. Most of it would have been adults, for adult consumption because it's an expensive luxury. Then with the Industrial Revolution, not only does sugar refining and sugar harvesting get cheaper so that the price comes down, the beet sugar industry is created by Napoleon and the French during the War of 1812, and then by the 1850s, beet sugar is being produced in temperate areas of the world, and simultaneously, you've got the invention in the 1840s of the candy, chocolate, and ice cream industries. So they start being mass produced, and then in the 1870s, you see the soft drink industry comes in with Dr. Pepper, and then Coca-Cola and PepsiCo. And so sugar consumption is going steadily upward throughout this period. By 1920, we hit 100 pounds per capita of sugar in the U.S. for the first time. And then it continues to slowly rise, and you change the way we consume it during this period. So if you think about even drinking soft drinks, until we had refrigerators and freezers and vending machines, they were something you had to go to your local drugstore or soda fountain to purchase. So they were still something of a luxury. The 1930s, you get, again, refrigerators, all these artificial cooling systems come in. Fruit juices begin to be sold, made available throughout the country in the 1930s, and then frozen concentrates appear right after the Second World War. And then in the 1950s, you finally get sugar-coated cereals, because the cereal industry was born from the health food health industry in the turn of the century. Both Post and Kellogg, before starting cereal companies, originally ran sanatoriums for sort of the well-heeled dyspeptic. Cereal was a way to get them to eat fiber and ease their stomach, gastrointestinal distress. So they fought the sugaring of their cereals for 50 years, and then they just gave in to market pressures. And you could see each one of these companies are always arguments between the nutritionists and the companies who were fighting against sugar because they thought it was poison, and the marketers and the financial side that said, if our competitors are selling sugar-coated cereals, we have to do it. And so then by the 1960s, you've taken something that was, again, a once-a-week luxury 150 years previously, and has now been transformed into something that we feed our children, at least in some households, from the moment they wake up, from the glass of orange juice, which is effectively sugar water with vitamins, to the sugary cereal, to the, Coke or Pepsi or candy bar at the morning work break, to, so whatever sugary beverages consumed with lunch, desserts, et cetera, at all. None of that existed 150 years previously. And the point, as this is happening over a 150-year period in the United States, and then you could see it happening over a 20 to 30-year periods in indigenous populations throughout the world, or sort of launched full speed from their traditional lives into this Western diet and lifestyle. As that happens, you see diabetes go from being an exceedingly rare disease to, today in America, 1 in 11 Americans having diabetes. In some populations around the world, again, in some indigenous populations, you've got, 1 in 3 or even 1 in 2 adults with diabetes, a disease that prior to this Westernization and sugar saturation of their diets would have been exceedingly rare.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Gary Taubes, a science journalist, about his latest book, The Case Against Sugar. In fact, you say there's been an 800% increase in diabetes from 1960, and that coincides with the rise in the consumption of sugar, but you also just said that, we reached a peak of sugar way before then. So
what's happening?
Yeah, what's happening? Some people say it's high fructose corn syrup. Other people say it's any kind of sugar, including honey. What is going on here?
So let me give you the numbers. So again, since the early 1960s, if you believe the Centers for Disease Control and their statistics and their changes in diagnostic criteria, but since the 1960s, there's been a massive increase, 700-800% increase in diabetes prevalence. So you can see this epidemic beginning in the 19th century, right after the Civil War, in effect. And you can see the numbers going steadily upward, and physicians commenting on the numbers and calling it an epidemic by the 1920s and suggesting it's being caused by sugar consumption. Yeah, by 1920, we're already eating about 100 pounds of sugar per capita, or the sugar industry was making available 100 pounds. By the 1970s, it's about 120 pounds. Then it kind of drifts downward over the 1970s because there's a lot of people who are arguing that sugar is poison. And then with this sort of liberation of sugar in the 1980s and the high fructose corn syrup coming in, it starts to soar again. So by 1999, when it peaks, where the industry is making about 150, 155 pounds of sugar per capita available to the American public. So that's a 30-fold increase from the early 19th century, 30 or more. So that's what we're looking at. Then the question is, why would diabetes rates continue to go up or go up more, even though the sugar consumption, you know, by 1920, we would have expected a lot of diabetes from 100 pounds of sugar. And there are other factors that get involved. So the third to last chapter of my book is called the If-Then Problem 1. So there are two major if-then problems with this idea that sugar is toxic. So the argument I'm making is that sugar causes a condition called insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is a fundamental defect in type 2 diabetes. So I'm arguing that sugar is the cause of type 2 diabetes, which is the common form that associates with age. And then insulin resistance associates so closely with obesity that we can at least speculate that it plays a causal role there as well, in which case sugar is a cause or the dietary cause of obesity. And you could see that this has been studied very clearly in Native American populations, particularly the Pima population that lives in Arizona began experiencing epidemic levels of diabetes in the 1950s and 1960s. So the National Institutes of Health set up a research lab in 1964-65 to study them, and they've been studying this population ever since. And what you see is that as mothers who are insulin resistant, that means they're obese or they're diabetic or they gain a lot of weight in pregnancy or they become diabetic in pregnancy, a condition called gestational diabetes, have a vastly increased risk of giving birth to children who are now predisposed to become obese and diabetic themselves and become insulin resistant and repeat this process or sort of accelerate this process in the next generation. Because when those, you know, girls grow up to become women and get pregnant, they will be at an increased risk of being insulin resistant, obese, diabetic, gestationally diabetic, and then transmitting this problem on at a higher rate to, you know, their kids in the next generation. That's an explanation for why diabetes and obesity just exploded in this Pima population, and you see it appearing at each generation at younger and younger ages. And if the same thing happened in America, so the researchers discussing this refer to it as the vicious cycle of the intrauterine environment, because the intrauterine environment, the uterus of a woman with insulin resistance is going to affect her child's predisposition to become insulin resistant itself. So this vicious cycle would have happened in our population as well, but over a slower time period, because we had more time, in effect, to get to, you know, modern levels of sugar consumption. So the explosion we're actually seeing in diabetes levels since the 1960s could still be very similar to what's happened in the Pima. It just took us a little bit longer to get there. And we had more exposure to sugar all the way, so we were a little bit more adapted to the sugar in our environment.
Gary Taubes. His latest book is The Case Against Sugar. And we'll talk more after the break. Stay tuned.
And now, the Riverdale Carnival presents the Archies.
Take care of the kissing booth while we're singing, Sabrina.
Okay, everybody, here we go with our new hit record, Sugar, Sugar.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today about sugar and how, as my mother used to say when I was growing up, sugar is poison. I had a terrible sweet tooth, but it was rarely indulged thanks to the eagle-eyed vigilance of my mom. She wouldn't even let me eat the Halloween candy I used to collect on my trick-or-treat rounds. A great injustice, I thought at the time, but according to Gary Taubes, my mom was right to be so vigilant. His latest book, The Case Against Sugar, says that refined sugars and refined grains are metabolized differently in the body from other foods, leading to insulin resistance and setting us up for diabetes and other metabolic disorders. Here, I asked Taubes to explain just how that process happens. Now, I wanted to just understand, do I have this right, that sugar, in especially refined sugar or high fructose corn syrup, they're processed in the liver, which then directly produces fat as a result of this, rather than going to supply energy or building muscles? That's kind of the sugar, obesity, diabetes connection?
Kind of. It's a little simplified. So what we know is that, as I said, type 2 diabetes is a disorder of insulin resistance. So when you're resistant to insulin, you need to secrete more insulin to, in effect, handle, diabetics would say, to cover the carbohydrates that you're consuming. And if you're insulin resistant, it means your cells are not responding to that insulin well, and so you need more insulin to do the same job. So for X amount of carbohydrates, you need more insulin if you're insulin resistant than if you're not. And we also know that that insulin leads to, when insulin is elevated, your body will accumulate fat. And it will have trouble mobilizing and oxidizing fat so long as insulin remains elevated. So now the question becomes, what causes this condition called insulin resistance? And what's known is that insulin resistance associates very closely with fat accumulation in the liver. So, and again, there's another condition that's epidemic in America today and around the world called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is where you get accumulation of triglycerols, which are fats in effect, in liver cells to the point that it starts, you know, the liver starts malfunctioning. There's signs that insulin resistance starts even earlier than that, through a different kind of sort of fat accumulation defect in liver cells. In this case, something called diacylglycerol. So triglycerols are three fatty acids bonded to a glucose molecule. Diacylglycerols are two fatty acids. The liver cells are making triglycerols. They go, you know, they take one fatty acid and tie a glycerol on, and then they add a second, and they have a diacylglycerol. So the idea is that it's this diacylglycerol accumulation that's causing the insulin resistance or some aspect of this fat accumulation. And we know, you can also show in animals, that when you liver cells have to deal with fructose at high doses, they turn it into fat and the fat accumulates in the liver. So you've got this sort of series of steps that are tested. What we don't know is whether the whole story is true or whether there are other factors involved entirely. That's where, you know, speculation comes in. I'm arguing it's likely enough to be true that we should be seriously worried about it, and we should be making decisions just as we do in climate change based on the likelihood that it's true, because we only have one environment, one atmosphere, we only have one body, you know, our own. So, but that's the causal pathway is the fructose and sugar gets metabolized in the liver. In the context of this high glucose, high insulin environment, the liver cells try to convert the fructose into fat, and in the process of doing that, in this high glucose, high insulin environment, the liver itself becomes insulin resistant, and then that translates to sort of systemic insulin resistance, and now you're on your way to obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, also diseases that are highly, you know, are associated with insulin resistance and probably in a, you know, somewhat causal manner.
Now, the Atkins diet, when it came about, I don't know, in 1970s or 80s, it also was warned against carbohydrates. It was a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet. It warned against carbohydrates of any kind, including things like carrots. So I wonder if you could take up this question of, is it carbohydrates in general that we have a problem with? I mean, we have to eat something, right? And are whole grains okay? And, you know, unprocessed grains okay? Or is it just sugar?
Well, so we're asking two different questions. The question I'm addressing in this book, The Case Against Sugar, is what's triggering these epidemics of obesity and diabetes that happen anywhere in the world when populations transition from their traditional diets and lifestyles to Western diets and lifestyles. So this includes populations like Southeast Asia that ate a lot of rice and didn't have obesity and diabetes, and now they're getting high levels of obesity and diabetes, still consuming a lot of rice. So what do you have to add to the rice to create these epidemics? And I'm arguing that sugar is the prime suspect. It's always been the prime suspect. It should still be the prime suspect, and there's compelling evidence. Now, a different question is, once you have a population or individuals who are predisposed to be obese and diabetic, what do you do about them? How do you prevent them from getting that way? And those who have already gotten that way, how do you reverse the problem, if it's still possible to reverse it? You know, some damage done is always going to be irreversible. You never know. You know, you're hoping that it isn't, but inevitably that's just the way life works. So what do you have to do to reverse the problem? So clearly, if sugar is the cause of this epidemic, you got to get rid of the sugar. Okay, that's, you know, one implication of this book. On some level, you know, some people can tolerate it in moderation, and some people be healthy in moderation, just like some people can smoke cigarettes in moderation, and some people can smoke two packs a day and live to be 100. But many of us, to most of us, can't, and many of us, to most of us, will be healthier if we get rid of the sugar. So now the question is, what about the other carbohydrates? And here's where, you know, we tend to give advice, public health and diet advice, to the whole nation as though we're all identical. And it doesn't matter if we're a 5'7", 120-pound marathon runner or a 6'5", 300-pounder who used to play pro football and can't get off the couch anymore, that we all get the same advice. And that's, you know, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, lean meats and proteins. And what I'm arguing is, and I have been arguing in my books, is that for those people who are predisposed to get obese or diabetic and they gain weight easily, and we know who we are, or we know who we become in our 30s, for those people who are already obese and diabetic, then for them, the carbohydrate content of the diet is problematic. And, you know, not green leafy vegetables because they have a relatively low carb content. It's bound up with fiber. But everything else, whether it's starchy carbs like potatoes or carrots, whether it's fruit like bananas, apples, oranges, anything with that a diabetic would have to cover with insulin, would have to give him or herself insulin to, you know, to tolerate, is probably something they should not be eating if they want to be lean and healthy. Now, not everybody wants to make the trade-off, just like there's still 10% of the public still smoke cigarettes, regardless of what they can be pretty confident they'll do to them. But, you know, for those people who want to be as lean and healthy as they can be, and if they're predisposed to gain weight easily, to go down this road from health to insulin resistance to obesity, diabetes, and heart disease, then, you know, all easily digestible carbohydrates, and including the starchy vegetables, are foods they should avoid. And, you know, the fruits other than berries.
Wow, that's scary. Just the idea of not being able to eat apples and carrots, you know,
but
which
are
so healthy.
But think about it again. I mean, you know, historically, well, that's, you know, a lot of the arguments I've made in my book is that we embrace, remember we talked about even the role of science in determining how we think about issues. So our ideas in the sort of health value of fruits and vegetables as inherent part of a healthy diet came from this research up to the 1930s. In the 1920s and 1930s, it was called the New Nutrition, linking the absence of vitamins and minerals to vitamin and mineral deficiency diseases in populations, so beriberi, pellagra. By the 1940s, that was translated into this idea that we should eat as many vegetables and fruits and food, different kinds of foods as we could, the balanced diet concept, because that way we'll maximize the possibility that we won't end up with any vitamin and mineral deficiency. And yet when researchers were coming to those conclusions, they knew of populations that ate very limited diets and were exceedingly healthy. So the Inuit, for instance, which lived for all intents and purposes on like caribou and seal meat and, you know, fish, or the Maasai in pastoral populations in Africa, the warrior class of the Maasai that lived on milk, meat, and blood from the cattle they herded. And, I mean, there were populations, hunter-gatherer populations, where the word vegetable meant, you mean what we have to eat when we're starving. And these populations, the Native, the Plains Indians, the Native Americans of the Great Plains, are another classic example of, you know, they were not farmers. We turned them into farmers in an effort to civilize them, as we called it back then. They lived almost exclusively on, you know, buffalo and elk and animals they could hunt, and they were seemed to be extraordinarily healthful. So again, one of the things I did in my research is to go back and try to break out of these thought patterns that were determined by the available technology, and that was groupthink to a large extent, and then connect it to what people like Atkins said, which was, you know, I mean, it's fine to miss apples and carrots if it's a difference between, you know, maybe you would weigh 135 pounds and versus 125 pounds. But if the difference between a diet with apples and carrots is, you know, 300 to 180, you might be perfectly happy avoiding those foods if you knew that's what the difference was.
Wow.
And clearly there were people, and even in when I was reading about the history of, so Atkins was just the first who came along pushing this, I mean the most famous who came along pushing this low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet idea, which was completely supported by the biological understanding of fat accumulation that we learned in the 1960s, but was considered by the experts, in air quotes, to be irrelevant to the science of why people get fat. But earlier, there was a researcher who worked in the medical sciences division at DuPont, and they were worried about DuPont executives having a heart attack. This was in the late 40s and 50s. And So they tried to get their obese DuPont executives on low-calorie diets and low-fat diets, and they didn't work. And finally, they tried this low-carb, high-fat diet, and it was remarkably effective. And there was a throwaway line, and the fellow who wrote about this and published in the journals, Pennington, had a line where he said he had one obese DuPont executive who lost 50 pounds effortlessly on this low-carb, high-fat diet, but if he had a single apple, his weight loss would stop.
Wow.
And so it's sort of, it's hard to imagine. And yet, such things are certainly possible. And if you were that person, the question would become, how important was that apple to you? And even Atkins, in his advice, said what he prescribed to people was, you know, get rid of the carbs. And he had various stages of the diet. So you get rid of virtually all the carbs except green leafy vegetables. So you get to the point that you've lowered your insulin levels and you're now mobilizing your own fat and burning your own fat for fuel, which is what you want to do with it to get leaner. And when you get to a weight you like, then you can decide how much you missed the foods that you restricted. So rather than make the decision in advance, compromise biologically and physiologically on how this program works, and maybe not lose the weight, decide it's a worthless diet and fall, you know, and that the thinking behind it is wrong. Instead, say, look, what I want to do is, you know, I want to be healthy again. And I made this decision. I was a smoker. When I decided I wanted to be healthy, I didn't think about how many cigarettes I was going to allow myself or whether or not I'd miss the cigarettes. I knew I would. I just made the decision I was going to quit smoking. And even then, it took me 20 years to succeed. And that's basically what Atkins said. If the carbohydrates are literally making you fat, then remove them. Get down to a weight you like, that you're happy with. And now you can say, look, do I really miss the apple? Do I miss the carrots? If I miss the carrots, I'm going to go I'll add carrots back into my diet, and I'll see what happens to my weight. If I start gaining weight back again, I can make an informed decision. Do I want to be 15 pounds heavier with carrots or 15 pounds lighter without? But at least I'll understand the effect and what the trade-off is. So to me, even when I began my research 15 years ago, that seemed like a very reasonable way to approach the problem. And one of the reasons why we all fail is because we start off thinking, oh, I'm going to miss the carrots, I'm going to miss the apples, therefore I'm going to compromise. And because I compromise, I basically defeat the physiological phenomenon that you're trying to induce here, which is the mobilization of calories from your fat and the use of those calories for fuel.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Gary Taubes, a science journalist, about his latest book, The Case Against Sugar. We've been speaking about your book in the context of the changing scientific notions of what causes diabetes, whether it's the calories in, calories out, the overweight issue, or whether the cause is sugar. But you also put this within the context of the industry, of what you call big sugar. In fact, you write, what the sugar industry accomplished in the 1960s and 70s raises vital questions about how an industry should respond when confronted with legitimate, albeit ambiguous, research suggesting that its product is dangerous. And this is very much, you know, familiar to those of us who have followed what happened with big tobacco, what is happening with, you know, big fossil fuels, the whole denialism of industry. So I wonder if you could kind of add into this mix the economic interests that were behind pushing sugar into our diet.
Well, and again, you notice that I said it raises vital questions. I don't actually have answers for it. But, and my take is much more nuanced on this. And if you think about how I got involved in this, this is the context. So, as I mentioned, I literally stumbled into I figuratively stumbled into the nutrition field with this controversy over whether salt causes high blood pressure. So the salt industry felt that they were being unjustifiably, that its product, salt, was being unjustifiably vilified by by zealous nutritionists who had decided that salt caused high blood pressure and didn't really care what the data actually showed. They were going to interpret the data to confirm their beliefs regardless. So one thing the salt industry did, and today we would call it playing by the tobacco industry playbook, is they hired researchers, the best researchers they could find, to reanalyze the data and to report what they thought the data really showed. So they went out to find independent researchers, and these independent researchers, when they reanalyzed the data, basically concluded that the salt industry was right. Then when I got involved as a journalist, I had both what the sort of anti-salt researchers were arguing, because they were publishing in the journals, and then I had the papers that had been paid for by the Salt Foundation, which is, and they were independent researchers, so this is the, we'll call that the anti-anti-salt literature. And then what I did is I took all that literature, I printed out stacks that were over a foot tall of all the key papers in the field, and I found my own referees, the best epidemiologists I knew, and biostatisticians, who had never been involved in this controversy, had never taken money and research money from anyone to study it, and I asked them to read the papers and assess them for me. And I said I would buy them expensive dinners at the restaurants of their choice in their home cities. That's the best I could do, okay, which I did. And all three of my independent referees agreed with the salt industry's assessment of the data. So salt had been unjustly vilified by the establishment researchers, and they had to hire people from outside. And I was able to do what I did because the salt industry was defending its product. So when the sugar industry basically was doing the same thing, the problem with tobacco is a slightly different story. The evidence against tobacco was unambiguous, 20-fold increases in lung cancer rates in smokers versus non-smokers, and where we won much such as we have the tobacco wars, we did because they were manipulating the, trying to, you know, nicotine was clearly addictive, they knew it was addictive, and yet they were trying to generate evidence or pretend it wasn't. And that's what led to these huge tobacco settlements. So in this case, the sugar industry, when they started being attacked in the 1950s, when there was an article circulated in the newspapers of President Eisenhower putting saccharin in his coffee, and the explanation was his doctor told him sugar was fattening. The sugar industry was, of course, horrified because they believed that there's no such thing as a fattening food, that it's all about calories, and the only thing that matters is whether you overconsume calories or not. It doesn't matter whether those calories come from sugar or quinoa or kale or grass-fed beef. It's the calories that matter. So they spent $750,000 putting out an advertising campaign, huge sum at the time, saying that what the nutritionists and obesity research believed was true for everything applied to sugar as well. And then in the 1960s, when nutritionists started suggesting and researchers started suggesting that sugar caused heart disease through what they didn't realize, but today we would recognize as this insulin resistance mechanism, the huge consensus in the field was that dietary fat was the problem. And so the sugar industry just hired researchers who thought dietary fat was a problem. In this case, they picked two at Harvard, and they paid them to write papers saying what they believed, which is the problem was fat, not sugar. And then in the 1970s, they repeated this. So they kind of did, they took what the researchers gave them, and what the researchers were giving them was fat causes heart disease, obesity is caused by all calories, diabetes is caused by obesity, sugar is benign. And they paid those researchers to say what they believed. And when I wrote about this in an op-ed in the New York Times, the headline was, you know, the sugar industry's biggest allies, the nutritionists. And this was a fundamentally different situation than what happened in tobacco. The difference, the problem is, you know, the sugar industry was wrong. At least I think they're wrong. So they were defending themselves from fringe aspects of the community, but those fringe aspects of the community happened to be right. We could, another example of this would be the GMO controversy today. So clearly the genetically modified organisms. So the mainstream science community thinks these are harmless and well tested, and the benefits are, you know, far exceed the harms. And then there's a fringe element of the community that thinks that the harms can't be, you know, calibrated, and that we have to worry about them, and therefore they have to be considered worse than any benefits. And then you ask yourself, what should the industry itself do? Because the consensus agrees with the industry, but say 20, 30 years from now, we might all have epidemics of some horrible disease we never even imagined because of GMOs, in which case, in retrospect, whatever the industry did other than support the fringe element would be the wrong thing to do. And so it's, you know, I don't know what the answer is. And one of the joys of being a journalist is we only have to raise the questions and critique whatever anyone chooses to do when they try to answer it. But it's tricky.
Well, it certainly is an argument for robust scientific research that is independent of the industry. Let's say the kind that is being shut down now by having its budgets withdrawn by the Trump administration.
I think the best way, I like to think all my books, I have three books now on nutrition, they're all ultimately arguments for better science. The question is, somebody has to decide what that science is going to do, what questions are going to be asked, and if you have groupthink dominating a particular institution, there's always going to be groupthink on some level. The question is, if it's incorrect groupthink, the people doing that incorrect groupthink are going to be the people determining what questions have to be asked, and so they're going to continue perpetrating the bad science. So the question I've struggled with since my first book came out, Good Calories, Bad Calories, in 2007, is how to establish a system by which the right questions get asked and the right research gets done independent of industry. And in a case like this with sugar, I think they have an obligation to fund the research. But if they fund the research and pick the researchers, nobody's going to believe them. So maybe they could put, you know, $100 million in escrow, and then you have a group of independent, very independent expert scientists decide what research has to be done and select the researchers and oversee that research. And then if the sugar industry turns out to have been right and sugar is harmless, the government gives them the $100 million back. Unfortunately, we don't live in a country where either people or food products are considered guilty until proven innocent, which is kind of what I'm arguing here.
Right. The precautionary principle. Well,
yeah.
Gary Taubes, this book is really fascinating, The Case Against Sugar. It's published by Knopf Random House, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you very much.
Gary Taubes. Go to writersvoice.net for links to his articles, including his latest, For Children's Health, The Government Has to Treat Sugar Like Cigarettes. The government in question is the British government, but the point is relevant to our own. Coming up next week, we talk with journalist Amy Sutherland about her book Rescuing Penny Jane, One Shelter Volunteer, Countless Dogs, and the Quest to Find Them All Homes. Don't forget to tune in. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.